The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. Yeah. The more times I hear my bio, the less it sounds like me. Like, those are all true, but it feels very remote and fails to capture something. Excuse me. So I wanted to just open it for a few minutes if there are any questions. Last time you guys stonewalled me, but I have forgiven you and want to see if there's anything. And it could be questions about your practice or what's arising or integrating Dharma into your life.
So, since you've been here, several times I've returned to the Rumi line that you said a couple of times, enough times so I got it written down, that we live in the nowhere, or I think it's a command, live in the nowhere you come from. I'd really appreciate it if you'd talk about the meaning of that to you, and help me understand it.
Yeah, that's a line from a poem called "Tending Two Shops," and the way that I think about it, the way that I approach a lot of Rumi and language like that, is that it's doing its best to point at a very unusual and strange and yet very natural experience. And if we take it as a kind of description of the state of affairs or something, as ontology, I think the philosophers would say, we get into trouble. We just think a lot about it. But if we take it instead as a kind of evocation of what I would just call, under the umbrella of mystical experience, then it's simpler. And what it's pointing to, as far as I understand, is something that is echoed in the Buddhist teachings with the language around emptiness. And emptiness, we don't usually think about it as literally feeling empty, but there are some states or modes of awareness where there is a sense of like body, mind being utterly empty, not even a shell of something. And the only thing that we can say is that there is knowing arising, and that there is, it's free of dukkha, it's free of suffering. Now he says, live in the nowhere that you come from, even though you have an address here. Right? Acknowledging, some people would call it like relative and absolute, but I actually don't think we need to invoke two realities to understand it when we consider it simply as an experience. And the fact that you like that line, it's like rattling something in there and resonating with something. And that's good. That's good. You'll know it when it arises. And Rumi starts to make more sense deep into silent retreats, I think. Anything lingering? Is that at all helpful?
Yes. I guess a lot of my experience with Rumi has been of being able to immediately feel like I've taken a little journey with him.
Yeah.
And so this one not so much. And
yeah.
In part that's why it's been rattling, because I expect to connect, you know, across the centuries, which is of course amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And across the translations, and that's another piece.
Right.
And I guess in my practice of late, I am thinking more about the being rather than the emptiness.
Yeah. excuse me. Good. Keep going. Sounds good. And there may or may not be any opposition between being and emptiness. Yeah. Thanks. All right, you win again. Last chance.
The biggest challenge I have in my life right now with being my practice of being present or my mindfulness practice is either while driving or while attempting to meditate.
Yeah.
But let's just focus on the driving. And so I'm curious if you have any suggestions, practical and otherwise, on how I spend a lot of time in the car on a daily basis. You know, I go to graduate school in San Francisco, so I have a lot of opportunities for practice, and I feel like I've run out of basically every single tool that I've been given in trying to be present and be mindful with my driving. And I've become very frustrated. So if you have anything on how to work with that particular space in our lives, which I know probably many here also experience.
Maybe this is self-evident, but why do you want to be mindful when you drive?
I mean, others, so that I don't like it crash. So there's a big safety concern. I find that sometimes I am so distracted within my own mind, I am not paying attention to the road. So that is paramount to me. That is a life and death thing. And I feel a responsibility to myself and to other drivers on the road that I need to be more mindful while I am driving.
Yeah.
It is definitely a safety issue.
Yeah.
So that is a primary motivation. But I think also it's, I think it's a place where I think my monkey mind thinks that it's like a free-for-all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then it's kind of a double frustration.
Right.
With serious ramifications and consequences.
Yeah. The in the most sort of highly utilized measure, psychological assessment questionnaire for mindfulness, one of the questions is, there we go. One of the questions is, I drive places and don't remember getting there. That's like one of the questions, you know, to assess mindfulness. And the car in LA or the Bay Area, that's high bar practice. A couple things come to mind, which is to potentially to actually have like the insight timer that's just sounding bells. You can program it so that it's actually sounding bells at random intervals, and you just kind of notice where your mind is. You can do some practice in the car in the sense of actually using the visual field as the kind of anchor for your attention. And you don't have to screen out thoughts, and thoughts are obviously important in anticipating, but you can actually maintain some contact with the visual field, which will feel quite different than just acquiescing to the default state of the mind. So there's a kind of intensity to it. There's still some openness, but there's a kind of it's like being rooted in the external visual field. Another piece is just the momentum of practice. You know, sometimes in certain situations that we're just kind of doomed to a certain level of unconsciousness. And it's outside of our capacity to change it in those moments, actually. But what that can actually inspire us is to dedicate ourselves to practice in a more sincere, deeper way. And so there's a kind of gathering of motivation around that when we really see ourselves struggling, or when we feel like we just don't even know how to let go in those moments. One more,
Sort of Western Buddhist teachers. I've probably, been practicing for probably 15 years. And, in the last 6 months, I've been listening to Dharma Seed tapes while in the car sometimes.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting. Sometimes I'm going to work, or I'm doing errands, or I'm sort of in the very pedestrian day-to-day parts of life.
Yeah.
When I'm listening to these. And I've noticed like a thought comes into my mind, which is at a certain point, I sometimes feel like a lot of teachers have been on so many retreats and sort of been approaching it from a more, their experience is of life is as a teacher, not that they're not dealing with other parts of life as we all are, but there are many times where I kind of will listen to a talk, and I guess I ask this to you since you're a teacher in training also, but some teachers are, you know, I feel like they stay in touch with the laity, if you will, but I have this recurring feeling that at a certain point their experience of life in the West and my experience as you know, a working stiff, it really diverges. You know, riding BART every day and, you know, just all the rest of it. So I just wondered if that is often brought up, addressed, thought about by students or by teachers.
Well, it, you know, these teachings, they, if they're not relevant, you know, for how we're living our lives, they're close to useless, I would say. They're sort of like nice philosophy, you know, or not nice philosophy, you know, thin. So in some ways, the value of the of teachings is that it actually can take root in our lives as we live them. A lot of the talks on Dharma Seed come out of retreat centers, and so they are the tone and tenor of those kinds of talks are going to be a bit different, and the instructions for how to be mindful in daily life is different when you're on retreat from when you're living your life. But what I hear is just a little sense of kind of disenchantment or a sense of where's almost like looking for certain teachings to come to life. And I think don't look out for that, you know, like where is the Dharma, and meaning where is suffering and where is the possibilities for freedom from suffering in your life. And I think in the course of a Dharma life, we go through different phases where the teachings and teachers and Dharma talks have different meanings and different roles to play for us. And sometimes they're absolutely fundamental and they keep, you know, I do know people that sort of the backbone of their life is participating in groups and listening to talks and but then that changes. And we have to become, there are phases where we sort of put aside a lot of the teachings and start to write our own Dharma. And it sounds like you're at a phase where there's some impulse to do some of that. And and the utility of other voices is sort of diminishing. And it doesn't mean that it won't be more relevant at some point again. But it sounds like it should be a time of some kind of self-reliant exploration and reconsideration of how you're practicing, what you think the Dharma is, how it takes life in your day-to-day routines, and where it can fill in more fully, be my thought. Yeah. Thanks. Appreciate it. Did you?
It's something that keeps popping up, but I've been thinking about how, you know, we hear about these different companies that are doing like life extension and, you know, 3D printing our organs and artificial intelligence. And I've been wondering, like, how does that affect mindfulness and Buddhism? And I don't know if that's the sort of question to ask here, but I've been a little curious. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, a few things come to mind. I had some acquaintances who were following a kind of calorie restriction regime because it looks like maybe it's associated with longevity and. It is in animal models, animal research. And I remember they were like quite restrictive. I forget how many calories they were eating, but it was their whole life was kind of organized around life extension. And I just kind of, it's a question about what is life for, and how much of it do we want, need, and what does the kind of preoccupation with longevity do to the moment and how we're relating to it? As one association, sort of a little unrelatedly, the artificial intelligence thing. What comes to mind is the movie Her, Spike Jones. You seen that? Joaquin Phoenix falls in love with his operating system. Like, it's like an iPhone, but really good. I found it very rich with Dharma themes about what is the nature of self? What does it mean to be in love with someone, with something? And what is it in them that we're loving? Are we loving the Atman? Are we loving the self? What is that? And the more I get into Dharma stuff, and there are a lot of aspects of the Buddhist teachings that are compatible with us being maybe a form of artificial intelligence, actually. I've never quite articulated it that way, but how we think about who we are and versus how we think about artificial intelligence, maybe there may be some convergence, actually. But I am speaking above my pay grade right now, and so I'm going to stop. Thank you, though.